morning.
Good morning.
Thank you all for being here this morning. Recognition of true emptiness does not arise from a preconceived notion of nothing at all, or from a preconceived notion of dependent co-arising or interdependence. A palpable recognition of true emptiness is what comes forth when the mind does not hold on to anything. Shoto Harada Roshi said, "To experience this essence is zazen, this place, here and now, of no attachment, this free state of mind is zazen." He said, "We have to reach the limit of words and practice zazen to find true understanding. No matter what we say, we do not reach the true essence until there is nothing left to say." Because the true essence doesn't speak and can't be said. Zazen is not thinking about liberation or edification or a better experience. It's letting go of our stuck places by letting be and not looking away from what we see. It is experiencing the unity of the entire field of our experience. Dogen referred in a number of his Dharma Hall discourses to seeing impermanence and being free from egocentric mind as the basis for what he called functioning freely. In the Shobo Genzo Zui Monki, he wrote, "As a monk, or I'll say, as any person who has left home, as we have all left home this morning, renouncing our normal Saturday engagements to be here together in this way, first," he said, "you must depart from your egos as well as from desire for or concern with recognition, gain, good reputation, good fortune, etc. All of our expressions of self-clinging. Unless you become free from these things," he said, "although you practice the way, it will amount to nothing but meaningless trouble and have nothing to do with emancipation." Or to quote another Roshi, "You will only be adding to your burden." I was asked to provide a title for this half-day sitting for the Ebright announcement, and I offered Zen Freedom, Zen Enjoyment. One might wonder, as I began to wonder in preparation for this talk, how can you talk that way at a time like this, when there is so much violence and warfare all over the world? and so many people who are hostage to it. So many people losing their lives. How can you talk of enjoyment when there is so much suffering without implying some oblivious, privileged self-indulgence? My answer today is, I do so out of devotion to directing my attention and, to the extent possible, encouraging others to do the same. Directing my attention to the cultivation of a freedom and enjoyment that surpasses common understanding. I'm talking about the cultivation of a presence of mind that can stand by and with and attune to and respond appropriately to what is needed in this suffering world, as I am able to, as I am called upon to in the various circumstances of my life. Until doing so much of what I find difficult, uncomfortable, frightening even, on behalf of others becomes as natural as reaching for a pillow in the night, as natural as reaching for a child who has fallen and is distressed. I was walking recently out on the bike trail, Sacramento River Trail, and as I came back, I noticed a father with his daughter, apparently, very small girl, I would guess 3 or 4 years of age. And when I saw them at first, they seemed very happy, and he was next to her, and she was wobbly, and I smiled. And as I was getting back to my car, I lost sight of them, and all of a sudden there they were again. And the little girl just suddenly fell, and her legs went this way and that, and I was waiting in anticipation of what came next, which was this hysterical crying. And I looked at the father, and I wondered what he would do. And he seemed like he froze. And I felt some pain. And then I went back to readying myself to drive away and was considering various things, like the most appropriate response is not always to reach for the person, for the child. And as I was driving away, I looked again and I saw his body language. And he was pulled back and a little bit collapsed in the chest. And he looked so overwhelmed by the distress of this little one. So unable to function freely is what it appeared to me. This cultivation of which I'm speaking, this practice that we do together, underlies the best of what I feel I have to offer in any given moment as a person of the way. To say that I'm a person of the way is not to put myself above anyone. In fact, I believe we're all persons of the way, whether or not we're awake to our indivisible lives, whether or not we share the feeling, as Suzuki Roshi might say, of our indivisible lives. or share the feeling of the compassionate wisdom and free functioning that the way, the Dharma, has to offer. Still, the Dharma is totally inclusive. We are all here in the way. In the way things actually are. Dogen said, we see and understand only what our eye of practice can reach. He didn't say we see and understand only what our intellect can reach. Every moment we're living out and creating for others life experiences based upon the projections of our own minds. And mostly we're believing what we think. As sometimes, well, so much so that many of us are inclined to argue our views. And sometimes we must, out of compassion for the many, or for the few. But also many people are willing to fight for beliefs in rights to freedom. And not only fight, but will take the lives of others. And this kind of freedom is so tragic, so limited and easily disoriented, and ironic and fragile, and perpetually under attack, this constructed freedom. On this path of Zen, we look with radical honesty and courage, in silence and stillness, at our own deluded minds. In Zazen, we sit with all of our ancient twisted karma and we allow it to compost itself, to break down. We smell it decomposing and feel its heat as it begins to cook. And we develop the capacity to not look away, to not run away, to not reject or grab on to the myriad things coming forward from and through our mind in ways that actualize the sense of a separate self, a separate life of vicissitudes and vulnerabilities. We take time to look at this heart-mind moment after moment. In this way, we take full responsibility for the mind. And it's so poignant, and it's terrible, and it's beautiful and wondrous and heartening. And it makes no sense, and it's undeniable. We practice sitting in silent observation of life and death, in full acceptance of what is, until we recognize the peace, the freedom, and even the enjoyment that surpasses common understanding. In the place where the separating notions of you and me, us and them, that lend themselves to so much conflict and pain, in the place where those notions don't make any sense. This is where we find the freedom. When we practice in this way, we burn the seeds of greed, hatred, and delusion. A burnt seed can no longer sprout. In Sanskrit, they refer to this as dagda bija. And we slip the knots of the heart. So that more and more when we get up from our seats, we're increasingly capable of enacting or enacting violence, and more sensitized and alert to and capable of intervening in the subtlest and most pervasive expressions of greed, hate, and delusion. The subtlest are the easiest to overlook, to disavow. And often the most blinding. Until we see others as ourself and ourself as others, we are extremely limited in our ability in terms of bodhisattva liberative work that we're able to do on behalf of all beings. Until we can become silent and still, intimate with all of our resistances, and reach the limit of words, and come into the feeling of true understanding, totally inclusive, free functioning. Until then, we're mostly sleepwalking in what Dogen called delusion throughout delusion, or the dragon's cave. And we're probably causing problems of which we're completely oblivious, as well as those of which we're all too well aware. So this all implies not ignoring causation and at the same time not falling under its yoke. Suzuki Roshi said, real freedom is to not feel limited when wearing this Zen robe, when wearing these vows, when wearing these precepts. This troublesome formal robe, these challenging commitments. Similarly, he said, in our busy life, we should wear this civilization, this karma, this truth of cause and effect, without ignoring it and without being caught by it, without going anywhere, without moving in Zazen. Without escaping it or trying to get away, we can find composure, he says, peace, freedom, in this tragic karmic life. This practice is not an intellectual exercise. On this middle way path, we're admonished and we devote our lives to realizing freedom in order to bring others across. But we're admonished to not deny cause and effect in seeking this realization. We've taken a human birth. So on this path, we don't aspire to dissociate from human feeling. or graduate from the need for skillful means or restraint, or from the challenges of meeting others where they are, expressing genuine care and respect for their well-being. We don't forsake others on the way to our own complete and perfect wisdom. In preparing this talk, I was reminded of two Zen koans that express this admonition that I'm referring to. To not turn away from, in other words, ignore, and at the same time to not get caught in the massive fire of delusion. The first case is case 154 in a collection called Entangling Vines. And it's not a collection that we talk about so much in the Soto school, though I have had teachers who have expounded on some of the cases in that collection. It's a collection more familiar to those in the Rinzai school. This is case, as I said, 154. And the story goes, there was an old woman who supported a hermit for 20 years. She always had a young girl, 16 or 17 years old, take the hermit his food and wait on him. One day she told the girl, give the monk a close hug and ask, what do you feel just now? So she did. And the hermit responded, a dead tree on a cold cliff, midwinter, no warmth. The girl returned to the woman and reported what he said, and the woman said, for 20 years I have supported this vulgar good-for-nothing. And at that, she threw the monk out and burned out the hermitage. I won't add my own commentary to that koan, but will allow it to stand on its own. Leave you with the words of the koan itself. There's really nothing to decipher. The second koan is in the Book of Serenity. It is referred to as Baijong's fox, and in the Mumon Kon it's Hyakujo's fox, which is the Chinese. And I'll read both of the main cases. The language is slightly different, and so I think it helps in the turning of this case to hear both versions. And this version is the Mumon Kon. When Hyakujo Osho delivered a certain series of sermons, an old man always followed the monks to the main hall and listened to him. When the monks left the hall, the old man would also leave. One day, however, he remained behind, and Hyakujo asked him, who are you standing before me? The old man replied, I am not a human being. In the old days of Kashyapa Buddha, I was a head monk living here on this mountain. One day a student asked me, does a man of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation or not? I answered, no, he does not. Since then I have been doomed to undergo 500 rebirths as a fox. I beg you now to give the turning word to release me from my life as a fox. Tell me, does a man of enlightenment fall under the yoke of causation or not? Hyakujo answered, he does not ignore causation. No sooner had the old man heard these words than he was enlightened. And this is the version in the Book of Serenity. By Jones Fox. When Baijong lectured in the hall, there was always an old man who listened to the teaching and then dispersed with the crowd. One day he didn't leave. Baijong then asked him, "Who is standing there?" The old man said, "In antiquity, in the time of the ancient Buddha Kashyapa, I lived on this mountain. A student asked me, 'Does a greatly cultivated man still fall into cause and effect or not?' I answered him, 'He does not fall into cause and effect.' And I fell into a wild fox body for 500 lives. Now I ask the teacher to turn a word on my behalf." Baijong said, "He is not blind to cause and effect." The old man was greatly enlightened at these words. Suzuki Roshi commented on this koan in a few of his lectures, at least a few. In a talk that he gave in 1971, he said the following about this case. There are some ellipses in this excerpt, so if you want the full exact language, you can go to the transcript, but I cleaned it up a little bit, so to speak. Hyakujo said, "You must follow the law of karma, even though an enlightened person. As long as one is a human being and has a physical body, it is not possible for him not to follow the law of karma." So, he could understand, Hyakujo could understand the reality he felt from both sides. That is why he, the old fox, could banish from the Zendo. That kind of fox shouldn't exist in a Zendo. In a Zendo, there must be, you know, only student and teacher. Teacher or student is each being, you know, in the realm of particularity. So, what you can see is each student. You cannot see the absolute or the old fox. I wanted to say a little bit more about the karmic nature of cause and effect. To which these koans are referring. In a practice period that I participated in Tassajara some years ago, David Zimmerman was leading, and the theme or the focus of that practice period was karma, and there were a number of books that he recommended on the subject that were, I thought, quite good. This one is a more contemporary book called Karma: What It Is, What It Isn't, Why It Matters. And it's written by a Tibetan teacher who studied with masters from all the four major lineages of Tibetan Buddhism. He was also a great scholar and well-educated about contemporary Western religion and psychology. oh, I'm sorry, I didn't say his name, and I don't know how to pronounce it correctly, so excuse me. It looks like Chale Kyokgon. A narrow meditative focus may help with our concentration, but it will not avail us of any information, and so will not give us any insight. We are just watching our thoughts in doing this. On the other hand, if we follow through and observe the interconnections unfolding, we will notice our sensory perceptions are impacting our thinking patterns and our feelings and emotions, and that all these things are mutually co-influencing each other. It is through conscious awareness that we come to see the breadth of all this activity. We come to realize that our thoughts about ourselves and the way we come to think of our actions and interpret their impact on our environment and others are always changing. We are always within a dynamic context. Karma is vitally linked to Buddhism's goal of reducing suffering. And the more we understand how we create karma, the greater the chance we have of realizing this. The less we understand karma, the greater the chance that certain actions will be repeated, that we will fail to learn from our mistakes, and that we will perpetuate our suffering through the enactment of deep-seated habits. So I'm addressing these, what you might call two sides of our practice in this way, because I have noticed over my years of practice the tendencies to fall to one side or the other, to the absolute, to focus entirely on transcendence, or to fall into entanglement with our karmic lives. We are, on some level, always entangled. But we are also free. And the freedom and the entanglement are like this. And that can be seen when we study it, when we get still and silent and don't look away. And in many ways, it turns out to be a great gift to the people in our lives. More and more we see how we're changing and how we're better able to respond freely for the benefit of others and ourselves. The practice that we have in Zen for the cultivation such a person is zazen. So, to return to Suzuki Roshi, when you are able to sit without being attached to any image or any sound with an open mind, that is true practice. And that you can do that means you are already absolutely free. So under the difficult situation, without escaping from it, we should have complete freedom from the circumstances. Adversity or easy circumstances. and with a very resonant excerpt from Harada Roshi's commentary on Hakuin's Song of Zazen. Harada Roshi is a great living teacher, Japanese teacher, who's gotten quite old and is mostly in Japan these days, but he used to come quite often to a center on Whidbey Island of Washington. And lead sesshins, and I had the great good fortune of sitting a sesshin with him there. And I was so moved by the fact that in every single one of his lectures, in which he spoke often of Hakuin's teaching, he also said something about Dogen's teaching. And I know he's beloved by many Soto students, and so perhaps out of compassion for the wider Zen Sangha, he, knowing he has students in both schools, he often includes references to Dogen's teaching. And I'd like to extend that spirit by quoting a passage. To meditate means to realize inwardly the imperturbability of the essence of mind. This is the very center where there is nothing whatsoever. We have to come directly to this, not being lax or wandering around in our thoughts. We have to return here where there is no doubt or confusion. Then we will easily recognize our face before our parents were born, no matter where we see it. Without fail, if we see our own original clear mind, then even if we are in a busy, chaotic downtown, we don't miss it. When we get home and relax and we're so glad because it's our home, we can settle so comfortably. We have to be able to pierce through that, he says, that tendency to attach ourselves to comfort and familiarity and stop there. We have to be able to pierce through that and find freedom going beyond that in order to realize inwardly the imperturbability of the essence of mind, where we are not moved around by anything. I think we have a few moments if there are questions. I think I'd like to remain settled and quiet through the end of our morning of sitting together. So I would ask that if you have something more along the lines of a comment, that you refrain from sharing that right now. And let's just hear any clear and direct questions that you might have about any of the teaching that I offered this morning. So feel free to raise your hand or just speak up if you'd like.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for your lecture. My question is, do you think that the fox could potentially be your brain? Like, is he referring? I'll tell you why. I had a hearing test yesterday, and I went in for ringing of the ear, and basically she said something that was so zen and so powerful, which was, when you have the ringing, even the vets, they attach it to a negative emotion. And so when I came home, I thought, well, this is something that I can heal. And I was contemplating in my hot tub, I was like, why do I have this alien brain? And then I had to accept that it's not an alien, it's my human experience. And it's like a fox. It's tricking me if I'm drinking that Kool-Aid. And so...
Thank you. I think that's a great question.
Okay.
And I wouldn't say it's the brain. I would say it's a projection of the mind, which is why the fox could disappear.
Yeah.
Because the projection can be pulled back.
At the beginning of meditation, you said something that Zazen was sobering, and I was kind of mulling that over because I'm not disagreeing with you, but I don't feel that. What did you mean by that? Thanks.
You're in the study group, and one of the teachings of Suzuki Roshi's that we were recently discussing and contemplating is intoxication, not selling intoxicants, broadly speaking. And our minds are being intoxicated all the time by the kinds of thinking and stimulation that we indulge in. So when we're intoxicated by our thoughts, and it can be by beauty or by terror, you know, it runs the spectrum. The emotions that our thoughts evoke are intoxicating. Our beliefs are intoxicating. And so when we can drop all of that, open the hand of thought and release it, we wake up in a way that I think one can call sobering.
Sarah, I was offering it.
But Oscar, to your
right next to me.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you. You said something to the effect that kind of slipped by me. I'd like to hear it more about recognizing, realizing the unity of the totality of our field of experience.
Good recollection, Oscar.
Could you say talk a little more about that?
We have an underlying belief, which is notional, in separation. So, percepts, or you could say objects of perception, visual perception, auditory perception, we think that it's out there, separate from me. I think sound makes this more accessible sometimes than sight. I remember years ago having this thought, I hear that sound here, and I really became intimate that the sound happens here, but I have an idea that it's out there, that it's coming from out there, but it's arising here. But also, there is a kind of physical material world, and there is the element of space. But all of my experiences, so let's not say there's nothing outside of my experience, but all of my experiences are within this unified field. There's no experience out there. Everything is here. And so that's what I was getting at. Is that?
Thank you. So, so it's kind of paradoxical or multi-sided, because the sound is coming from out there through space, vibrations, but our realization, recognition, experience of all of that is internal.
Well, there's something we call sound waves that come from that are distant from our eardrum. Sound waves, and they impact the eardrum, and what we call hearing occurs. But if we're not connected by some unified field, how does that reach us? First of all, I mean, that's one dimension of it. Is the fact that I can be reached by everything implies a field that I am a part of, and that is part of me. So that's another dimension. It's maybe subtle. Yeah. Thank you. Anything else? Joey?
So you talked about cooking and composting the seeds of karma. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I don't really understand much about karma. I have a vague understanding of it. And I thought that, I'm not sure how you, yeah, so could you talk about that?
One thing I didn't say, thank you. There are two basic ways of understanding karma. In Buddhism, we usually are referring to what we call volitional action, things that I do intentionally. And that includes things that I don't understand. Meaning, sometimes we do something that's hurtful to someone, and we think, oh, I didn't mean to. I didn't understand what was happening. But still, the choice to engage in that activity was volitional. So there's a lot of action, activity in the world that's not karma. So maybe this book would be helpful. What it is, what it isn't, why it matters. We're thinking a lot in Buddhism about volitional action. And this is related to the fact of having precepts, yeah, living with intentionality. So that's karma. But I want to go back to the beginning of your question about composting. It's a metaphor. But there's a way when we sit and we settle, we recognize there's so much that we're always trying to get away from in our daily life. We're putting off, we're avoiding in one way or another. And when we stop, everything that has been unattended to comes up to be attended to in our sitting, to be seen. And a lot of what we've been trying to stay away from is painful, confusing, frightening. that everything that we've been trying to get away from, it gets lodged in the body. So to say that we compost it is to say there's a way in which that the energy of what is locked in the body and has been resisted can begin to be transformed in the light of our attention. And part of that process, when I was saying it cooks and it gets smelly, is we see a lot of things, tendencies about ourselves that are not so good. We also see wonderful things. I mean, really, we have to talk about what's wonderful because we don't avoid beauty consciously. And in the process of that breaking down, we start to see things more for what they are, essentially, versus all the layers of kind of stories that we put on top of basic experiences. And it's the seeing things more clearly for what they actually are that burns the seed of delusion. That was what I meant.